Radio.
Arguments are not going to attract people. Winning is going to attract people.
Radio.
Radio.
The Poor People's Riot, as they call it, was necessary, it was reasonable, and it was just.
Radio.
And if you get in my way to make sure that that man gets housing, or that he gets enough to eat, I will move you.
Radio. Radio.
Okay.
The genesis of Endgame, the book, was really because I did some talks around the possibility of fighting back, and the response by the audience was really predictable. If it was an audience made up of sort of mainstream environmentalists and peace and social justice activists, often they would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield, which is they would say the names Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, and Gandhi again and again as fast as they can to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And if it was grassroots environmentalists, they would do the same thing, but then they would come up to me afterwards and they would say, thank you so much for bringing this up.
Especially in North America, pacifists and nonviolent advocates have had a very defining role and even a censoring role in determining what other people's participation can be in a whole range of social struggles. And that the way that they've affected social struggles has made it very much easier for the state to control those social struggles. That nonviolence plays a function of recuperating social struggles, of taking out their teeth, making them harmless, so that they can just exist in this cesspool of democratic plurality.
I wonder, what happens to that kind of energy or idealism or faith that something is about to change when they're certainly not going to change at all?
What are the false hopes that keep us tied to the system? What are the false hopes that bind us to unlivable situations and blind us to real possibilities? Does anybody really think that warehouses are going to stop deforesting because we ask nicely? Does anybody think that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing because we ask nicely? I was talking to this person in the States several years ago, and they said, if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things are going to be okay.
We've got a couple of myths on the left that I would really encourage us to get over. The first is that social change happens by moral suasion. It doesn't. It happens by force.
The problem with persuasion as a strategy is that it only works on people who can actually be convinced and who can, you know, be relied upon to act from their position after their minds have been changed. And the problem is that we're not dealing with individuals who can be convinced or persuaded. We're dealing mostly with large, abstract social organizations and corporations, which are basically sociopaths made out of huge numbers of people.
You can't argue with psychopaths, you can't argue with fascists, and you can't argue with those who are benefiting from an economic system. You have to stop them through some form of force, and that force can be violent or nonviolent. Could you stop Ted Bundy by peaceful means?
The left, to a large extent, subconsciously, has as its primary role to make resistance harmless. States have recognized that resistance will never disappear, that struggles will never disappear. And in the past, they'd tried suppressing struggles the first time that they showed their heads, that there's any sign of them, and that proved ineffective. So nowadays, the way that states rule is by accepting the inevitability of conflict and resistance and just trying to manage it permanently.
Keep the march going. There's nothing happening here. There's nothing happening. Just one more line of police. So please keep the march going.
Social movements in North America are locked into this pacifist doctrine that is imposed by the middle class reformists who want to control the movement and dictate how it conducts itself.
Advocates of nonviolence, they frequently say that nonviolence works, and the principal examples that they use of that are Gandhi in India and Martin Luther King in the U.S. The problem with that is that this constitutes a really great historical whitewashing, that in fact the resistance in India was incredibly diverse, and Gandhi was a very important figure within that resistance, but the resistance was by no means pacifist in its entirety.
Gandhi gets used as a way to shut down conversation.
Especially in the West,
Gandhi's used as a way to sort of quell any ideas of either direct action or what's perceived as violence, or sort of like, you know, resistance that goes beyond what is seen as sort of like a pacifist or a peaceful means of resistance.
For years, I really bought into the whole Gandhian myth that is really sort of forced down the throat of activists in the United States. And the people who disabused me of that myth were when I first actually met some people from India. The people I talked to certainly didn't deify him, and many of them despised him. And they felt he was a collaborator, and he was somebody whom the British could work with.
Gandhi's very well known in the West, but when you go to India, there's a freedom fighter and revolutionary leader called Bhagat Singh, who's in India probably almost as well known as Gandhi, as a part of the independence movement and sort of a leader in the independence movement. But in the West, most people probably have never heard his name. And the reason why that is that he used direct action tactics. There were generals of the British army that were killed. There was a bomb thrown in a British assembly to basically attract the attention of the public. There were, you know, weapons that people were getting off of railway cars.
With Gandhi in the Indian National Congress, where you had the moderates and the extremists. The moderates were legal constitutional reform was their only method. And they were criticized for being a middle-class clique, for being too slow, for being too legalistic, and for being basically ineffective. The extremists, on the other hand, were being accused of being too aggressive, of being too fast and reckless and irresponsible.
Gandhi basically got negotiating power from the fact that there were other elements in the struggle which were even more threatening to British dominance. So the British specifically chose to dialogue with Gandhi because he was, perhaps for them, the least threatening of the important elements of resistance.
Gandhi came in as being the middleman. His theory of nonviolent passive resistance seemed to be a bridge between the extremists and the moderates.
The British were blood white after World War II.
Hello and welcome to OCAP Radio. You were just listening to an audio clip of Derek Jensen and Franklin Lopez. It's titled Resist or Die from submedia.tv. Excellent piece talking about resistance and violence in our society these days. So welcome to Friday, September the 3rd, here at CKLN 88.1 Ryerson University. I want to welcome you all to listening to OCAP Radio. Up next, we're going to hear a song, War is Crime, by Antibales Afro Orchestra. And then after that, we're going to have a fabulous interview from the Latin American Solidarity Committee. So here we go with War is a Crime. Thank you. Hi, and welcome back. You were just listening to War is a Crime by the Antibales Afrobeat Orchestra. Welcome back to OCAP Radio. Tonight we're going to be talking with Raul Burbano. Raul's from the Latin American Solidarity Committee, and the Latin American Solidarity Committee has been supporting the OCAP arrestees that were arrested July 21st for a special diet action that happened. Now, Raul's brother Ilian was arrested at that demonstration, and they've been doing a lot of solidarity fundraising for the special diet arrestees lately, and we're happy to have Raul here tonight. Raul, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Raul. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just great. Yeah. So, Raul, can you tell us? Now, we've talked quite a bit about the arrest that took place. It was that 11 OCAP members went into the Liberal Party headquarters to speak to the Liberal government about the cutting of the special diet. Now, Ilian, your brother, was one of the people who were arrested there.
Absolutely, yes.
And now the Latin American Solidarity Committee has become really committed to supporting Ilian for that arrest. Can you tell me a bit about the ways in which you guys have been supporting him and the other arrestees?
Absolutely. So the Latin American community and unionists also have joined forces to support those unfairly arrested and charged with, you know, what we consider these sort of illegitimate charges for direct community action that was legal and peaceful. So we also denounce, you know, the group as a community, in essence, the police response, which was excessive and intended predominantly to silence and intimidate members of the local activist community, including members of the Latin American trade unionist organizations, as well as criminalize them. So to stop them from further action, because, you know, we believe in the Latin American Solidarity Organizations, we've been working for a while on this, that these cutbacks are just the beginning of the austerity measures that it will be implemented, post G20, and it will affect directly, poor communities, immigrant communities, refugee communities, racialized communities, and also people with disabilities. So we feel that this issue is not, Canadians at large, being, new immigrants, people of color, so be it.
Absolutely. Raul, I'm sorry, I just need to ask you, is there a radio on where you are right now?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. Great. We're just hearing a tiny bit of radio interference, but
maybe in my background here. Let me just see.
Okay. but that's great. Yeah. So, what unions have become involved with this struggle, Raul?
Well, Ilian Burbano is co-president of QP3393,
mm-hmm.
and he's also coordinator of the Latin American Solidarity Network. So, predominantly, it's that QP Ilian Burbano that has been participating as a union member. But there is also LATUC, which is a Latin American unionist trade organization as well, who has become involved to politically support financially, publicly, these actions of the OCAP members, community members, and, of course, the labor battle.
Absolutely. Now, you've had a number of fundraising events held over the last few weeks. Are there going to be any upcoming events that you'll be holding?
So over the last month, or I guess over the month of August, we've had three fundraising opportunities, and predominantly they've been, to raise funds just in case, the legal process is going to get drawn out, and to support the 9 people that are currently facing the charges. But going forward, what we're expecting to do is now mobilize more around the education, around the impacts to the cuts to the special diet, the impacts to the communities within the Latin American community, to raise awareness as to how it impacts people of color and racialized folks. So we're moving more, I guess, transitioning more to the educational component of it.
Mm-hmm. And can you give me some examples of what that kind of education will look like?
It would be stuff like sort of panel discussions, having people, whether it's from unions, from different communities, partaking in panel discussions, putting together media releases, mm-hmm. Activities that would, within the communities, the Latin American communities or communities of color, to get them involved in understanding the impact it would have to them longer term. Because it's also important to understand that the policies that we're seeing here, the austerity measures, are going to expand and will impact, as we said, everybody within the community. So it's something that we need to organize. We have been organizing against. Many people in the Latin American community come from the Global South, Central America, and Latin America have experienced a lot of these cuts already, or austerity measures, because we've lived under, you know, governments of neoliberalism, where for the past 25 years there have been massive cuts in Central and Latin America to the social programs, all under the auspice of neoliberalism. So we've already, many of us come from there, have experienced these austerity measures. And we see that, you know, that sort of deja vu happening here in Canada as well.
Mm-hmm. And so is it typical of some of the austerity measures that have been put in place historically in the Global South? It starts with these sorts of smaller cuts to that the public may not gather as being affecting everyone in the population. Is that one of the points that you're trying to make?
And absolutely. And I also really disheartening is the contradiction of the policies of the current federal and also provincial government is, you know, the decisions to fund security, decisions to fund prisons instead of schools and community centers, you know, to cut public services, children, daycare, welfare. At the same time, giving huge tax breaks to corporations and banks are exactly what people, you know, during the G20, the peaceful protesters, were mobilizing against. Same type of actions that the peaceful protests for the OCAP members are organizing against. Mm-hmm. Because we believe that these policies only serve the interests of the wealthy at the expense of the poor. So this is what the government is telling us, that, you know, we have to do, we have to cut the deficit in order to maintain our economies. But at the same time, at a federal and provincial level, we see the government continuing to spend. We see close to $1 billion was spent for 2 days of security during the G20, we see close to $1 million to create artificial lakes for the Toronto Media Center during the G20. Canada, from a federal perspective, is buying 65 new fighter jets at a cost of like $8.6 billion, one of the biggest arms deals in the nation's history from a procurement perspective, and yet we have to cut $250 from the special diet benefits for people who really need it.
Absolutely. And do you have any numbers of how this affects the Latin American population here in Canada or here in Ontario?
No, I personally don't have any numbers with me, but it's clear that, it impacts, new immigrants, people who are, newly arrived in Canada in terms of people of color. Mm-hmm. I know, for example, I've read some stats that, for example, the Somali community was a big community utilizing some of this. So, it's members of our communities who are really going to be impacted by a lot of these cuts.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And it's always the most vulnerable in society that gets affected by these types of cuts. Now, the Latin American Solidarity Committee, do they work in conjunction with any campaigns going on in Latin America at this point, any parallel campaigns?
A lot of our work, the Latin American Solidarity work, is sort of twofold. One is, definitely working in solidarity with some of the transformations that are going on in Central and South America. Mm-hmm. Sort of learning from a lot of the popular democracies that have arisen in the Global South, whether it's Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador. And also here locally is working with our communities and the broader community as well in terms of understanding the impact, the social impacts that we're having here. Because, for example, people from the Latin American community come to Canada and the expectation is that, you're going to prosper here and things will do well. And then you see, many of the people in the Latin American community who, immigrants who come are doing a lot of the menial jobs that, Canadians, quote unquote, Canadians don't want to do. They have a humongous or very high dropout rate from school. So, we're not prospering as well as technically, we should be. So it's trying to understand and how to, build that link between the communities and the realities of what's happening today in Canada.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And there's a huge problem with people being given their proper residency here in Canada, too, among the Latin American community, from what I understand.
Absolutely. Undocumented workers that are brought from, Central and Mexico as well to work and to pick, some of the products that we use here. And, they don't have access to the medical system, to the healthcare system, to the legal system, and basically, are deported on demand.
Mm-hmm. And in many cases, from what I understand, they're asked to pay taxes here and then don't receive any of the benefits of being a member of the Canadian society here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's, and, so is there anything, what types of things is the Latin American Solidarity Committee doing around this stuff?
We do a lot of work, as I said, in solidarity with a lot of the transformations that are going on in Central and South America, but also, I mean, working within our communities here as well, from an educational perspective, getting communities involved, getting youth involved in activities that would lead them to, you know, paths that, you know, would otherwise land them places that aren't so interesting. So, you know, from mural paintings to sports programs to, you know, academic programs. So trying to get them a sort of a path where they can continue their development and become members of, I guess, productive members of society.
Right. And now, if there are folks who are listening out there who are from Central or South America who are looking to get involved, how would they get involved in the Solidarity Committee?
They could really send an email to, we have a website. Mm-hmm. They could really send an email. The best way would be to send an email to the Latin American Solidarity Network, mm-hmm. and that could just be done through my email specifically. So it's rburbano, B-U-R-B-A-N-O, at hotmail.com.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, thanks so much for being here. We appreciate you coming in and talking about this on the radio tonight with us. And good luck in all your future endeavors and all the support and solidarity that you're doing.
Well, thank you very much for having us. And I would just like to add that, you know, a lot of what's happened really is the criminalization of organization, of community organizations. So, you know, another reason why as members of the Latin American community, we condemn this, because many of us are involved in community organizing, you know, politically, socially, and we feel that, you know, these acts by the police and the state, in essence, is really a way to intimidate and criminalize peaceful and legitimate social organizing, and that's something that, you know, we want a lot of people to understand, you know, it has significant ramifications.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that's important important to know, and it's really important to oppose that type of criminalization of dissent.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thanks so much, Raul.
Thank you.
And we appreciate you being on, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. All right, so we were just speaking with Raul Burbano from the Latin American Solidarity Committee that has been doing some great work here in Toronto supporting different campaigns connected to folks from Mexico and South and Central America. So that was great. And we're almost at the end of our evening here at OCAP Radio. Just wanted to talk again a bit about what's been going on with OCAP. As an update, the defendants in the case of the OCAP people who were arrested on July 21st, and of course it's important to distinguish here that there were 11 people arrested on July 21st when OCAP went to speak to the Liberal government at their headquarters, there was a definite, an undeniable case of ableism that happened on that day. Two of our members were taken out and treated completely differently from the other nine folks that were arrested. That was Ann Abbott and Ann's personal attendant for that day, Lenny. Now they were taken in and treated to a different type of charge treated. They were taken and they were given trespassing tickets. Now that is a much lesser offense. That's a provincial offenses ticket, and that doesn't carry any threat of jail time, and that has no criminal record. And I believe, and it's a widespread belief that they Toronto police did this because they seem to indicate that they didn't feel that Anne was acting of her own accord on that day. I'm not sure. I mean, that's my opinion, and I'm sure that it has to do with the fact that they did not have a wheelchair accessible paddy wagon in order to bring Anne in, and that is the reason that they were not going to arrest them, and that was a pretty disgusting move on their part. Now the other nine defendants had a court appearance this last Monday. All nine people were were up in court together. Now, that was a set date, and that was where the Crown was scheduled to give disclosure, and the Crown did give disclosure to those defendants, which means that at this point the Crown has not dropped those ludicrous charges for those folks. So those folks are still looking at those charges. They haven't been dropped, and it's pretty disgusting. And we'll keep you updated on what happens with that. And if there's any more fundraising efforts for helping those defendants pay their legal fees. On that note, if anybody is interested in donating to the legal defense of the OCAP arrestees, please feel free to do so on our website, ocap.ca, or in person or over the phone to the OCAP office. And that's about it for our show this evening. Up next is, I do have a note here that says that Don Weitz's anti-psychiatry show will be back next week. So we're really looking forward to that, getting Don Weitz back on the air here. And also up next we're going to have... we are going to have here on CKLN 88.1, we have another show, and it's going to be a great one. Thanks.